ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 6th of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. Indigenous leaders are renewing calls for the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism to be expanded to cover all forms of racism and far-right extremism. It was announced yesterday that an attempted bombing at the Perth Invasion Day rally last month is being treated as an act of terrorism. First Nations advocates say their people are struggling with concerning levels of hatred. Isabel Masali reports.
Invasion Day rally organiser Roxanne Moore says every year death threats come with the roll.
Racism is a huge problem in our country, and it is, yeah, it's just really distressing that it's got to this point when we've been telling authorities about this for years.
The Noongar person and human rights lawyer has joined other rally organisers and elders in welcoming the announcement by authorities. A 31-year-old man accused of an attempted bombing at the Perth rally has been charged with one count of engaging in a terrorist act. Police allege he accessed pro-white material online. In a meeting with the WA Premier yesterday, the group called for further action.
From Bondi to Boorloo, this all comes back to racism and hatred, and that needs to be addressed. That's why we're calling for the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism to be expanded to all forms of racism and far-right extremism.
Hannah McGlade usually attends the rally, but she felt uneasy this year. She's a Manangkuran woman and associate professor at Curtin University.
We do have to take more action against racism, and we have to make sure that we are properly prosecuting racially motivated crimes.
It's not just Indigenous leaders worried about the rise in racism. WA Police Commissioner Cole Blanche.
I think we'd all be kidding ourselves if we don't see what's happening online and some of the hate speech towards Aboriginal people, towards any vulnerable community in this country. And again, I'm calling out for leaders, myself included. Our speech matters.
Marjorie Anderson is the head of Indigenous Affairs for Lifeline Australia and developed 13 Yarn, a crisis support service for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
I am seeing that rise across the country, and it's been building ever since the referendum. The referendum really kicked off racism. Well, it almost made it okay to be racist towards Aboriginal people.
She says even promoting 13 Yarn online has attracted racist trolling.
People talk about Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, but you never hear anybody, there's not even a word for racism against Aboriginal people.
Jumbana Institute Professor of Criminology Chris Kinnean set up Call It Out in 2022, an online register for First Nations racism. He says it's consistently received about 500 reports a year, though he argues incidents in the community would be higher.
And it is an ongoing issue that needs attention. Certainly what's happened in Perth will bring some attention to it, but even that, you know, as many people have noted, you know, the level of attention to what could have been a mass casualty event has been relatively muted.
When asked if the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism should be expanded, Premier Roger Cook said his government is committed to building a safe and inclusive Western Australia.
Isabel Masali with that report. The Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malindiri McCarthy, says she's been speaking with communities in Perth about the authorities' response to the attempted bombing.
In terms of the immediate work that was done, that's what they thank the police for. They recognise that there was confusion at the time. They recognise there's a lot of learning, and so does the WA police. And it was important to hear that and work through this and continue to work this through with the community, because there are questions around what happens with the next gathering and how can the next gathering be safe. So the community is well and truly moved beyond this in the sense of a blame game. What they want to know now is how they can feel safe.
The coalition reunification talks are continuing, but agreement still looks out of reach. The Nationals have sent the Liberals a counter-offer with their terms for getting back together, but the ABC has been told it's not likely the opposition leader Susan Lee will accept. For more, political reporter Samantha Dick. Sam, what are the Nationals hoping to achieve here?
Well, the coalition, as we know, is still divided, and the deadline is looming for Susan Lee to appoint a permanent Liberal-only frontbench if the Nationals can't get their act together. So National sources say they sent a letter to Susan Lee last night outlining a series of terms for the coalition to be reunited. Now, we don't know the details of these demands, but one Nationals MP told the ABC they actually didn't expect that these demands would be accepted by the Liberal Party. This really is all about buying more time for negotiations. So Susan Lee gave the Nationals until the start of the second parliamentary sitting week, so that's Monday, to find a way to come back together before making permanent arrangements. She's already outlined her conditions for reunification, and they include that the Nationals reaffirm their commitment to the principles of shadow cabinet solidarity, which is where frontbenchers must vote in line with the coalition's formal agreed position, and also that the three Nationals frontbenchers who broke those rules be suspended for the next 6 months from rejoining shadow cabinet. So that's until July. Now, Nationals leader David Littleproud has repeatedly said the return of the frontbenchers to the shadow ministry is a precondition of a reunion, which is partly what's caused this deadlock. But the tricky thing now is if there is no resolution by Monday and Susan Lee does appoint a permanent Liberal-only frontbench, that is going to be a lot harder to undo and will cement these divisions even further.
And we've heard from former Labor leader Bill Shorten. He's weighed in on this coalition crisis. What's he said?
He said he was concerned that the coalition's woes were representative of a larger restructure of Conservative politics. So as we know, recent polling has been showing a bump in support for Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. And while that support does fluctuate, Mr. Shorten said that the spike in polls for that right-wing party is larger than he's ever seen. He says there is a rise of right-wing populism across the US and the UK. He highlighted Nigel Farage's Reform UK party gaining traction, as well as, of course, the re-election of US President Donald Trump in 2024. So speaking to 7:30 last night, he said Australia was not immune to these influences as well. Here he is.
The traditional centre-right conservative parties are being replaced by populist right-wing parties. This is a complete restructure. And whilst Labor's got plenty of challenges with Indies and Greens, I think we are witnessing a complete restructuring of conservative politics.
So the coalition is deeply divided. We've got the Nationals who are pushing for right-wing, rural-focused populism, and the Liberal Party, which needs to appeal to moderate urban voters, many of whom potentially voted for independence at the last election. So interestingly, even though One Nation is pretty light on policy detail, it appears that they are doing a good job at picking up on the anger that exists in the community towards the major parties, with their messaging cutting through.
That's political reporter Samantha Dick there. And as we heard, One Nation is seeing this huge surge in the polls. Rachel Mealy takes a look at why voters might be drifting towards Pauline Hanson's party.
I think people are just out of gutful of the whole situation. They want change.
On the streets of Mackay in central Queensland, One Nation is on the minds of voters like Dave.
Look, haven't really read any of their policies, but I'm always interested to see what Pauline's got to say. And she's saying what the majority of Australians are thinking.
Dave says he takes a keen interest in what's happening in Canberra and says not enough's being done about housing.
You know, and I've got nothing against, you know, immigration's been going up. Immigrants built this country as much as anyone else did, but we've cooked the market through bringing in too many people. And, you know, look at people now, mate. You know, you got them sleeping in cars and everyday Aussies that are, you know, would normally be able to afford a home. It's just impossible now. So, you know, particularly, I mean, younger generation.
For Pauline Hanson, it's the perfect time to sound the battle cry.
I'm warning Labor now. You're on notice. We are coming for your seats.
A poll released this week by the Financial Review and Redbridge Group suggests one in four Australians would consider casting their vote for One Nation. Pauline Hanson and her party had already been gaining popularity in the polls, but made further ground in the wake of the terrorist attack in Bondi in December.
We're bringing in the wrong people into this country. The people we brought in don't want to assimilate. They have no time for Australia and hate our culture, our way of life, civilization, Western civilization.
The defection of Barnaby Joyce from the Nationals and this week's recruitment of former Liberal Senator Cory Bernardi has also put the party back in the news. Polls are showing a combined primary vote of 19% for the former coalition, while One Nation is well ahead on 26%. Griffith University political analyst Paul Williams says those numbers aren't going to go anywhere anytime soon.
So this is serious now. I mean, it's no longer, as Pauline Hanson herself said, you can't really call them a marginal party if they're the second most popular party in Australia, with its leader, the most popular leader, even more than the Prime Minister. So while they're not mainstream in terms of values, they're becoming mainstream in terms of activity and in terms of vote share.
One Nation currently holds 4 Senate seats and, thanks to Barnaby Joyce, 1 in the House of Representatives. With at least 2 years to go until the next election, can the party keep up the momentum and make a play for more seats?
They still might be polling 26%. But if you get if Liberal and National candidates or Labor candidates run third, and the Liberal and National parties and Labor Party all preference each other and lock One Nation out, well, that's going to do One Nation a huge mischief and keep them locked out of the House of Representatives. This is certainly good news for their Senate vote. Obviously, you know, Barnaby Joyce would win a Senate seat in New South Wales.
Associate Professor Paul Williams from Griffith University, ending that report from Rachel Mealy and Liam McNally. Australia is on the cusp of ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia, but experts say the pact is more significant symbolically than practically. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield is travelling with the Prime Minister in Jakarta.
Touching down in the Indonesian capital, Anthony Albanese is in Jakarta to officially sign what's already been promised to, a major security treaty between the two nations. It was on the shores of Sydney in November the countries agreed to consider a joint military response if either comes under attack and regularly consult each other on security matters. The PM celebrating it as a watershed moment and a sign of a new era in the relationship.
A partnership that is based on friendship, trust, mutual respect and a shared commitment to peace and stability in our region.
While the exact text of the document is yet to be revealed, Emeritus Professor of Indonesian Politics at the Australian National University, Greg Feely, believes its significance is mainly symbolic.
We shouldn't have too high expectations about what practical defence benefits this might have for us. I think it remains to be seen how far Indonesia would be prepared to go if there was a serious common security threat in the region.
And others share that view.
It's not really accurate to characterise it as a watershed moment in the relationship.
Susanna Patton is the Lowy Institute's Southeast Asia Program Director.
Although the agreement is positive in the sense that it reflects strong relations between Australia and Indonesia, because it doesn't signal any kind of redirection in Indonesian foreign policy. And in fact, Indonesia is continuing to do more with Russia, more with China. It remains non-aligned. And so the idea that Australia and Indonesia agree on the regional security outlook and what they would do in response to some kind of crisis is just not accurate.
Either way, the pact is the latest in a series of security deals Australia is making with nations throughout the Indo-Pacific and Southeast Asia.
In the case of the Pacific, it's about preserving Australia's position as the security partner of choice. In Southeast Asia, it's more about preserving a diversity of partnerships.
The Lowy Institute, Susanna Patton, ending Evelyn Manfield's report. Well, Thailand is heading to the polls this weekend to potentially elect its 4th Prime Minister in just 3 years. Voters are facing a tough choice, as Asia editor Karishma Vyas reports.
A swooning welcome for Thailand's caretaker Prime Minister Anutin Chanvirakul as he greets shoppers at one of Bangkok's famous floating markets. He's a favourite amongst conservatives and older Thais who are fueling his campaign for election victory. Anutin and his Bumjai Thai party is riding high on nationalist support after taking a tough stance against Cambodia during their deadly border war in December. Supporters like Nuntarat Kuploy say they're proud of his government.
When there was fighting along the Cambodia border, he allowed the army to perform their duty. He's a decisive leader and he loves the country.
Amongst this adoration, you'd be forgiven for thinking that Anutin and the Bumjai Thai Party were about to sweep the election. In fact, they're trailing in opinion polls, and one of the reasons why can be found in the city of Hat Yai. It's a major commercial centre in southern Thailand, but 2 months ago it was drowning in catastrophic floods. More than 150 people died and thousands were stranded without food or water for days as Anutin's government struggled to respond. Even now, locals like Kesarin Sangtohong haven't forgotten.
He only came here for a short time. He didn't manage it well, so he quit and he ran away.
This discontent is pushing many voters here towards Dr. Supat Hansuwanakit, a local health administrator who is a first-time candidate for the People's Party.
2 months ago, we suffered a massive flood crisis, yet the government provided minimal support to Hat Yai. For the most part, the people of Hat Yai have had to rebuild their city and their lives entirely on their own.
Dr. Supat and the People's Party have a tough fight ahead of them. As voters weigh a difficult choice ahead of Sunday's polls, many are concerned about what will happen after their ballots are counted. This is Karishma Vyas in Bangkok reporting for AM.
More pressure is mounting on the government to scrap the capital gains tax, with a coalition of frontline housing organisations calling for change. The calls accompany a survey showing demand is surging for crisis accommodation services. Oliver Gordon has more.
Marion Bennett works for Mission Australia, a charity that helps struggling families find housing.
We've seen demand for our services grow 19% in just 1 year. We're having to turn more and more people away.
The increased demand means the organisation's workers have to make tough decisions.
Like, who am I going to turn away? Is it the mother with her kids in a car, or is it the older woman who is living out on the streets?
A new survey of 70 of the country's frontline services reveals a sector under immense pressure. The study, published by the National Housing Campaign Group, Everybody's Home, shows 85% of organisations are reporting higher demand for services, and just under half of all organisations surveyed say they've had to frequently turn people away over the summer months. Mission Australia's Marion Bennett says many organisations are seeing staff leave.
An increased workload, an increased stress and burnout. So it does become a systemic issue when you're asking people to face these sort of difficult decisions day after day.
With frontline services at breaking point, many young people locked out of the housing market and rental costs going up in most capital cities, the federal government is under pressure to make housing more affordable. This week, reports have surfaced it's considering halving the capital gains tax discount, a mechanism which allows investors to pocket more profit when selling property. May Azizi is the Everybody's Home campaign spokesperson and hopes the government follows through on the change.
We can't afford to keep going the way we're going. Right now, the government is making a choice to spend over $12 billion a year, lining the pockets of investors to go out and compete with people who are buying homes to push up the cost of housing.
She's calling on the federal government to act.
I think we can see from the numbers and the responses to this survey that it's pushing people into absolute crisis and absolute breaking point. I think people who are being turned away from crisis accommodation when they're homeless would have very little sympathy for people who are losing a tax break on an investment property.
In Question Time yesterday, the opposition asked Prime Minister Anthony Albanese if he could rule out making changes to the capital gains tax discount on housing. The Prime Minister did not directly answer the question, instead highlighting that a Senate committee was formed last year to consider capital gains tax arrangements.
Oliver Gordon reporting. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Gold, who doesn't like it? Well, right now it's really having a moment. Its price rising about 80% over the past year in the United States, thanks to, I'm sorry to say, Donald Trump. Today, business correspondent David Taylor on gold and why people have been queuing to buy it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.